Hello, everyone, and welcome to another Fire Emblem Podcast, Season 5, Episode 2. I am Blazer, and with me I have my usual co-host, Shu.
Hi, I'm here.
it's a rare sighting. You know, I gotta, you know, pay money to show up here, so.
Yep, I got.
Come while you can.
Yeah, I got a sweet 75 cents for this podcast. If you guys need me after this, I'll be in the Caymans.
Alright, so what's our topic for today?
Our topic is a list that was made by various members of the Fire Emblem community, particularly members from Blazer's site, your site, Blazer, FireEmblemShrine.net.
Yeah, I remember you used to go there back in the day.
Yeah, I used to go there. No, long time haven for the hardcorest of hardcore Fire Emblem fans.
You can say that again.
You guys made a list of. Well, it started off as something that, you know, correct me if I'm wrong, a list of things that were missing from Fire Emblem Awakening, the game before Fates, for you guys keeping track at home. But kind of evolved into more of an analyzation of the more recent Fire Emblem releases as it relates to the rest of the series as a whole, mm-hmm. The previous games. True. Does that sound right?
Yeah. I mean, not even just, you know, Fates and Awakening, the most recent two, but, you know, even like Shadow Dragon and FE12. And just kind of like, it's not like an objective list at all of like, oh, like these are things the series did wrong, whatever. It's just kind of like, oh yeah, like these are things that like that changed, you know, like for better or worse.
Right.
You know, maybe you didn't realize it, or maybe there are things in the older games that like we took for granted, and then they kind of changed to like, yeah, like, you know, like I kind of missed that, like I didn't realize it until it was gone, that kind of thing. So I mean, basically, we're just gonna like casually go over the list. I mean, some of these are a lot deeper than others. Some of them aren't very deep. Like our first item is feet. I mean, they fixed that in Fates. So, we're good now. You know,
if you like feet,
we got feet like, now.
Yeah, if you like feet, Fire Emblem Awakening, not the game for you.
Definitely not.
I would skip that one if you like feet. But the second item on the list is chapter goal variety, Blake.
And I think this is pretty fair, because I know that one of the big things that people seem to agree on with Awakening was that it really missed like chapter goal variety. Like I've even heard like people who like that game, they're like, yeah, like I kind of wish though like they would have like had more different things, because it's usually just like defeat all the enemies or like defeat the boss or whatever. They kind of skimped out on like the, you know, defend this map for X many turns and, mm-hmm. you know, seize the throne. And kind of the more dynamic, you could probably explain this better, of like having a goal that's not necessarily just based on, you know, combat. I mean, it is a strategy game, so the goal isn't always just to like mow down all our enemies in other RPGs, at least not necessarily, right?
Right. No. I totally agree. And, yeah, in Fire Emblem 5, and I'm sure I've talked about this on the podcast before, there are quite a few escape chapters, and those being the chapters, if you played the previous games in the series, are...
Maybe a few too many escape chapters.
are chapters where you don't necessarily have to beat anybody at all, you just have to get your lord... Or in the case of Fire Emblem 5, everybody to an escape square, an escape tile on the map. And the curious thing about some of the chapters in Fire Emblem 5, Thrakia 776, a lot of those chapters, there were a lot of opponents on the map or enemy units on the map that you could not realistically beat with characters that have leveled up normally. Up mm-hmm. until that point of the game. And that always added an interesting dynamic, like you said, Blazer. There was a little bit more story to it. It was, not necessarily story, strategy to it.
Mm-hmm.
that you, it wasn't necessarily like all the chapters in the new games where it's your team beefed up against the other team, more beefed up than they were in the last chapter. It was in these escape chapters back in the day, they it was basically like, just try to get out of here alive. I remember one in particular where the enemy units would not even notice you until you got, until you like stepped in their movement, I guess. I don't know, but yeah. It added a really interesting dynamic that I had not seen in Fire Emblem before, and I don't know. I would like to see that kind of thing come back.
Mm-hmm. Yeah, I mean, they did spice it up a bit with Fates. I still think there's room for a little bit more. I don't remember seeing a lot of like a Seize the Throne kind of maps. Mm-hmm. There's still a lot of like, you know, defeat the boss and or like defeat all the enemies. But I mean, they did spice up the goals a little bit. But I'd still say like, you know, you've got a huge arsenal of ideas from previous games. So I mean, you know, why not bring back some of the more interesting ones, or you know, tweak the ones that maybe they were alright, but you know, they weren't all that great. I don't know. Yeah, it was just a thought. One thing I will say, you mentioned how, like, this is totally unrelated, but you mentioned how, like, there would be characters that are, like, way stronger that you couldn't realistically beat. I did kind of like that, just because, you know, like, I'm kind of a little kid at heart. I really like the whole power level thing, right, where it's like, oh, like, these guys are, like, super strong, and, like, yeah, like, you know, I'm not going to be able to, like, face off with them for, like, a long time. I just kind of like seeing that, as opposed to games where they always, it was just kind of level the enemies so that they're always, like, the perfect match for you, if that makes sense, right?
Yeah.
So, like, you know, you could be fighting, like, the big bad army early on, and, like, all the enemies are super incompetent, and you could be fighting them late game, and it's, like, it's the same big bad army, but all the enemies are, like, you know, they're all, like, your strength now, right? The game's just kind of, like, balancing it to you. Sometimes it's kind of nice to have that, like, plot, like, yeah, like, we're not strong enough, like, to take on these guys. But you have to be careful that, like, alright, if you always make the difficulty equal to the plot, then you could have, like, difficulty spikes and other stuff, which just aren't fun. But, yeah.
Yeah, no, I mean, and it's a better storytelling.
Right.
Component when you have characters like that where you meet them and you maybe go toe-to-toe with them, but you're not going to beat them.
You're right.
And you're running that into that with a lot of games that have traditionally very good stories. You probably see this in Final Fantasy a lot, but they're by no means the only culprits of this, but where you have a character that you meet, you can't beat. But
the unbeatable boss battle?
Right. Right. Yeah.
And that's the total story dynamic. Some people actually hate it, because they're like, well, if I can't beat this boss anyway, then why not, you know, like, why do I get to fight him? Well, it's like, it's to prove a point, right?
Yeah.
You know, like, this guy's older than you, he's been fighting longer than you, like, obviously he's not gonna, like, be the same level as you, right?
And it's setting up a bigger, better battle in the future.
Exactly.
That's gonna mean a lot more to you, instead of, like, you got almost the enemy of the bad guy of the week in a lot of Fire Emblem chapters, where you meet a guy in the chapter that you kill him. Like,
right.
Here's a guy, he's a bad dude, whatever, kill him.
Right.
And then,
right.
I mean, you don't remember any of those guys. So, that's why I like
Bad of the Beast or Glass.
Yeah. Well, okay, but those guys are unforgettable characters. How could I forget Bad of the Beast?
But yeah, I get your point. Like, I don't remember, like, you know, all the Lens Mode, you know.
O'Neill.
O'Neill. Another classic. Geb. Some of these managed to make a name for themselves in a single chapter, which is kind of impressive.
I think they make a name for themselves because they're so boring and one-dimensional.
Right.
Like, it's a joke, you know?
That's true, right. I mean, they get their, like, three lines of dialogue, and it's like, I'm dead. Damn. Like,
yeah. Like, how could this have happened?
I should just make a book of, like, generic, like, boss codes and death codes, because once you've seen, like, 20 of them, I feel like you've seen them all, like, I know there's a specific boss in Fates. This is just funny, that literally goes, like, I'm dead. I'm like, dude, you aren't dead, you're still talking, like,
shut up, dude.
It's a cheesy quote, like,
So, shall we move on?
Yeah, I'm sorry, let's move on. What's the next one?
Next item is villages and chests with competitive thieves.
So am I supposed to say something about that?
Well, I mean, you're the one who wrote this list, but I can start if you like.
I mean, you know what I'm talking about. So it's basically like in a lot of the older games, you would have villages, and it would be a race to get to the village before the bandits or the pirates or whatever it is gets to them. So you would have a kind of pressure incentive. You'd want to send off some units to intercept the pirates, and then maybe have another unit go to the village just to make sure. You'd have to be concerned about the AI, is the AI going to attack me, or is the AI just going to, straight go, destroy the village? Sometimes there will be characters inside the village, or, good items or whatever inside the village. You want to rescue those. Other times, you'd also have a game that I was playing a while back, FE6. If you, visit all the villages, or if you save all the villagers or recruit all the whatever, you get a bonus. So I mean, basically you have all these different incentives for getting to the villages. And I mean, with the chest, it's the same idea. It's just a little bit more direct. You have a chest and you have thieves going to the chest. So it's all right, I can I could turtle, and maybe the combat would be a little bit easier because I'm playing defensively. I just bait out every single enemy one by one. But the downside is I'm not going to get to that thief and get to kill that thief on time, or get to steal his lockpick so he can't steal it. Some chapters you even use thieves tactically. You're all right, I'll let the thief open the door, and then I'll kill him after he opened the door for me. Or I'll let the thief steal that item, and then I'll kill the thief and get the item, so that I don't have to have my thief do it, because maybe your thief's in a different location. So I mean, it just adds all this different dynamic kind of strategy, where it's I gotta position my thief here and send out the cavalry to intercept this thief or this bandit or whatever it is.
It totally forces you to overextend yourself when you're traditionally playing, especially if you've got a beefed up team that really doesn't, the enemies in the chapter don't necessarily pose much of a threat to you, and you've got your formation down, you're turtling your way through a map and just baiting, picking and choose
right
the enemy units that you're going to kill next, and you're really not having any problems. But when you have to compete with thieves and bandits and whatnot that are going to steal things from chests and burn down villages, you have to break up your formation. It's a race against the clock. You got to keep moving across the map, even if you don't necessarily feel comfortable putting a certain unit in a certain position where they might get killed. And it definitely makes things more challenging.
Right.
It makes these chapters more memorable, in all honesty.
Yeah, as well. Right. You feel more motivated, and it's you're forced to come up with a different strategy besides just playing defensively, which is always comfortable, but it's all right, this isn't going to work. Okay, I'll have this unit attack, and then I'll rescue him, or, I'll create a wall to, protect this one unit. You come up with different ways, and it just forces you to think in different ways. So, I mean, that's it. And they have done it in some games. It's not like they haven't done it all, but they just used to do it a lot more in the older games.
Yeah, I feel I'm probably not remembering this right, but I feel like it was almost every single chapter that had a good amount of villages, there were thieves that you had to compete with.
At least in FE6, it feels like,
oh, definitely
50% at least of the chapters have something you're mm-hmm. competing against.
That's the game I was thinking of, in all honesty. Yeah, right. That game was tough.
That's just the one I played most of the recently, but yeah. More saturated, vibrant colors. I don't know if you noticed this, but ever since really, FE11 had a really dull palette, and the graphics, as a result, people didn't like them. They fixed that with FE12 a bit by making it brighter, but they didn't actually change the graphics. The animations and everything were, basically still the same. And then they went to FE13, and, that was okay. But they started adding a lot more, browns and kind of darker colors. I think it's because they're trying to, emulate the, I guess, more of, the Western look. Japanese people love their, really colorful stuff. The Western looks kind of, more, dull and, quote-unquote, realistic or whatever. I just found the vibrant worlds of the GBA games and, I guess, FE9 a little bit more interesting. But this is completely personal preference. I mean, I also liked, FE5, and I think that generally had a darker palette. So, I mean, it totally depends.
I think I mean, I don't really have any sort of opinion on this particular topic, but I do find one thing interesting is that I feel like, and you can tell me if you've also noticed this, the East, I mean, particularly Japanese, when they have a piece of media that they want to, I don't know, give the impression that is very serious, they want to adopt those darker colors, make everything look like, I don't know, like it's
right, Saving Private Ryan or something. In a way that suits the newer games even less, like...
But yeah, no, that's what I was about to say. Like, it doesn't... It, for games that are not that serious, like Fates and like Awakening, you find it kind of... I don't know, like it doesn't fit, you know? I feel like those games, if they were... It would make more sense if they were more vibrant. That's, I mean, true, this isn't Attack on Titan here, you know? It's not something that's meant to be super serious. These games are kind of... I mean, I don't know. I mean, they're not serious. They're not serious in the way that an Attack on Titan is, or even the older Fire Emblem games that were more colorful were.
Yeah, you're definitely right. I mean, it's definitely a matter of suiting it, because, like, I mean, I play lots of, like, you know, dark games and whatever, and, like, I don't complain about those, because, like, it adds to the atmosphere. It fits the atmosphere. But here it's kind of like, all right, like, you know, you've got all these, like, cutesy character designs and, like, you know, tropey characters with, like, you know, different jokes and stuff, and, you know, like cool, like, fantasy settings, but it's, like, it's almost, like, hindered by all the, like, the darkness and the brown, and it just doesn't suit it as well, in my opinion. But, again, that's a complete, you know, opinion thing. So next we have late-game characters. You remember late those? Late-game,
like, Athos, the Barn. Mm-hmm. I think the name of the archetype is the Gato archetype.
Right, yeah, and that's because he was, like, the first character of that type.
Which, yeah. So, let me ask you this. Why do you think that people like these late-game characters so much? Or at least the people that made this list, why do you think?
I don't know if it's a matter of liking it. What I would say is that these characters add a kind of depth to the game. They serve two, maybe three purposes. So their first purpose is if the player is, like, not very good, they need some kind of what's the word, like some character to fall back on, basically.
I almost want to say, like, yeah, it's a fallback character. It's sort of like, it reminds me of rubber banding and, like, Mario Kart, where you don't want the people that are bad to be too bad.
Right, exactly. I mean, like, you're fighting, like, the final boss or whatever. You can't hold back for everyone, because it's like, all right, you know, then it's not going to be climactic. But at the same time, like, what are you going to do? So, you know, you give him Athos, who can, like, you know, take on most of the final chapter himself. Or, you know, Tybarn, however you want to say it, is just, like, super awesome. You know, you have these super strong characters for, you know, people who, you know, maybe they didn't, you know, they're not that good at FE or, you know, whatever. Maybe their best character died, so, like, now they don't have anyone. You know, you don't want them to get into a situation where they can't beat the game because they don't have anyone, right?
Right.
Go ahead.
So, yeah, I don't know. My stance is that, like, I don't mind these characters, because sometimes it's done very well. Like, Tabarn was set up. Tabarn didn't just show up in the middle of the,
For no reason,
you know? And,
right. And that was honestly, my second point, was that it's going to be, like, story-related. It has that depth of, like, here's a super strong character that's, like, he's been an NPC for a while, and, like, now I get to play him, and it's, like, super cool.
Like, yeah, that is cool. And but it's not as cool when you have a character that come out of nowhere, like they did in Shadow Dragon, which the Shadow Dragon just doesn't have very good writing in the first place, because it's an old game. It's an old game. That's the case. But so yeah, I don't know. I think it can be done well. I don't necessarily think that it's a good or bad thing. Mm-hmm. I think that if it fits the game, it should have one. If it doesn't, it doesn't.
Yeah, I just kind of miss it, because I guess the last thing would be that these characters tend to be older characters, and now the newer games have such a young cast of, like, you know, because, like, everyone has to, like, marry everyone, so, like, everyone's, like, marrying age or whatever, or, like, or isn't married for some reason, and, you know, they're also worrying about, like, you know, building up the characters and all that. So they don't like to include these characters late game. If you look at, like, the recruitment, like, a recruitment list for all the games, you'll notice that the late games for the newer games, there's very few, if any, characters. Like, I think Awakening, the last characters you recruit in the main game are, like, Basilio and Flavia, and, like, 4 or 5 chapters before the end of the game. It's slightly different from, you know, like, recruiting a character, like, the chapter before the final chapter or during the final chapter. And I mean, like, okay, you don't get to use them much, but it just kind of adds a little bit of again, like, depth and dynamic to it. To the story or whatever. So yeah, that's just a thing. Again, you're right. It's not technically a good or bad. It's just something that some people might miss. So how about the next one? Character cameos and villages, fights, like, before they join you, or appear as enemies. So, I mean, here's a classic example you should remember, is the one in FE8 where you see the general early on. Do you remember that one?
Yeah. And actually, the one I always think of, like, that, I think of that one, and I also think of seeing Hector before you really get to see him in action in Fire Emblem 7.
Oh, yeah. You see him, if I remember correctly, in a villa, in a house in Chapter 7.
Yeah, in a house.
Yeah. I mean, even Elliewood, like, he comes in and, like, he saves Ninian, like, at the end of the chapter, and I forget, like, what exactly they were doing at that time, but, like, you know, it's cool because you, like, it's not his story, but, you know, he takes on the role of, like, an NPC there, you know, 4 chapters or whatever before you actually get to play him. And then there's that perspective change, and it's just cool.
Yeah, and I don't know, I think of when I was working on that hack that never saw the light of day, a couple years ago, a big part of the world building and the storytelling in our minds was going to be done through these houses, because you can't hit people over the head with tons of just, like,
direct world setup. Narrative.
Like, yeah. You can't just say, this is what the world is like constantly. People are gonna check out after a little bit. But if people do want to take the time to look at all the villages, they should get a little bit of a something extra. I mean,
exactly.
I don't know. In my opinion,
that's how you do it. You sprinkle the lore around, right? You know,
right. You want to be with all sorts of little cool nuggets and maybe, like, a little bit of extra foreshadowing. You know what I mean? Like, they give you, I mean, the people that look and read everything, they're going to have a little bit of a better idea. I mean, they should have a better idea of what the world is like.
Exactly.
And the people that don't.
And they have a greater appreciation for their game as a whole as a result.
Absolutely. I mean, it's just better crafted. That's set in stone. I don't think that every house in a Fire Emblem game needs to have, like, a character like the NPCs in Pokemon that don't say anything at all. Like, I like mowing my lawn or whatever, something.
Right. I mean, a lot of them do. A lot of them are like, you know, did you know the weapon trialing is this? And it's like, yeah, I did. But, like, you know. But I mean, like, some of those are okay, right? Like, that's a good way of, like, you know, sprinkling in extra information. You know, but at the same time, like, yeah, you do want to also, you know, world build.
I think the point is you want to reward somebody for looking at all these houses that you put in the game. I don't know about you, but I remember going to houses and villages, and I mean, besides for the items that you sometimes get, I would go into a house and then they would say something like, that was a waste of time. Why'd I do that?
Right.
I wasted that move hoping that there was something
worth it. No, worth, you're totally right. But when there is, it's like, it's cool. It's like, oh, yeah, like, I'm glad I did that, right?
Right, definitely.
All right. You want to do the next one?
Yeah, next one that you have here is unique battle themes as opposed to renditions of the map theme.
Do you know what I'm talking about?
You're talking about music, right?
Yeah. I mean, specifically, like, so, like, the newer games, they have the map theme, and then they have the battle theme. And in most of the cases, the battle theme is just, like, a faster paced, like, more upbeat, you know, dramatic, whatever version of the map theme, right? Mm-hmm. And they actually do this, they do this cool thing where they like, created the songs and time it, whatever, so that, like, as you go into the battle, it plays from the same part that the map theme was playing on, but it just plays, like, the, you know, the upbeat version or whatever, right? The battle version. I think this is a pretty cool effect. It definitely, like, helps with the continuity or
you know, immersion or whatever. But at the same time, I also have a deep appreciation for having unique battle themes, just because I really like the games like FE6, FE7, FE8 especially. I'm going to get crap for mentioning those games, but like they're the ones that I remember the battle themes a lot for, like, specific characters, or even just in general. You know, powerful foe, you know, softly with grace, everything into the dark, campaign of fire, Zephiel's theme, and the name of Burn. You know, there's just so many different, good themes, or it's kind of like, instead of like having it that transition from like a map theme to like a glorified map theme, it's kind of like a transition from like a chill map theme to like epic battle, like, you know. So, again, it's not an objective better or worse. It's just something that I think some people maybe missed. It's something they could go back to, maybe. How do you feel about that?
I believe that, I mean, now that you're talking about it, I'm a big proponent, because I believe that, I mean, it makes things, I'm all about making these things in these games memorable. You know, and if every, when you do have those unique battle themes, not only, like, when you hear the song again, you're going to be thinking of a specific battle, a specific chapter. You know what I'm saying?
Uh-huh.
And that's, and you're right, it adds to, it makes them more memorable. I mean, there's a reason why you can list off that, pretty much that entire soundtrack. And not necessarily for the game with the less interesting score. You know what
right.
I mean? Like, it's more memorable.
And I think even Radiant Dawn, I believe, I think it had, I forget exactly, but I believe it had different, like, normal battle themes, depending on, like, which part of the game it was, as well as, like, different boss themes. And, I mean, they still have, like, unique boss themes, but you generally don't hear them as much, and they're generally created to be very in tone with the map theme, as opposed to having a very different dynamic. If you listen to, like, some of the map themes versus the battle themes in the previous games, there's a very, like, clear difference in the feeling. You're like, yeah, like, this is, like, a dedicated map theme, and then there's, like, yeah, this is, like, an epic battle theme. And they just give you different vibes, and I guess that just kind of, I don't know, I guess you could say it helps with immersion in its own way, you know, getting into the battles or whatever. Because when it comes to Fire Emblem, in the end, you're always just watching the battles. You're never contributing. It's a simulation game, right? So, like, if I'm going to watch the battles, might as well be, like, full-on epic, right?
Yeah. So, on the topic of music variety,
like, mostly the same instrument and sound. Reading what I saw, mostly the same instruments and sound to music throughout. So, I believe whoever wrote this meant that, basically, some games have a very, I guess, limited tone with their music. It's not necessarily a bad thing, but the music can get a little bit boring if you're always using the same kinds of instruments. You're not really, you know, experimenting with the different music. All the music starts to blur a little bit. You get kind of like, you know, like, hey, that song sounds like really similar to that song. I mean, it's not like any game is, you know, completely, you know, free of this. And you want the game to sound like it has one cohesive soundtrack. But, like, I would say Radiant Dawn is guilty of this. Because I don't know if you remember that game, but it actually has a really good soundtrack. But everything's, like, super instrumental for the most part. And then there's, like, a few, like, upbeat, like, drum songs and guitar songs. But I only remember, like, the very instrumental music, and it all just kind of blurs for me. I couldn't really appreciate the soundtrack until I, like, listened to it afterwards, and, like, I finally started to, like, piece out the melodies now that they, like, I don't know if that makes sense, but basically the music all sounded the same to me at first, so.
Yeah. Yeah, I don't know. I mean, I've never really been
that much attention to the music,
but I do kind of understand the idea that you don't necessarily appreciate or I don't know, really get your head wrapped around a soundtrack until you kind of picked it apart, like you said.
Uh-huh.
I know I feel that way, not just about music, but, like, I don't know, movies and honestly a lot of video games. I don't really know how I feel about something until after I've already, like, experienced it, and I sit and I, like, just kind of let it marinate for a while and think about it.
Yeah. Basically, all I'm saying is I like to see a little bit more, what's the word? Like, willingness to, like, try out different, like, you know, song types. Like, it'd be awesome to hear, like, and Fates, like, they went for this very, like, everything's, like, Japanese sounding. Like, you don't have to do that. Like, you know, throw in some other kinds of songs that don't fit with it, and it'll sound good. It'll be more memorable that way. Because, it contrasts, basically. That's really all I want, contrast between the music. Because if you contrast between the music, then each individual piece of music is that much more memorable. And that's all it comes down to.
All right. So now that I finally got that, quality map design instead of open, sometimes symmetrical, bland maps, and then also quality use of terrain and maps to make positioning better. I think these two are probably related. You want to talk about them?
I don't know. It's almost like a hard thing to describe with the new Fire Emblem games, but they're definitely following this trend of, like they're almost trying to be influenced by multiplayer shooters in what they're putting together. Like, it's not always the case. I can probably pick out a couple chapters in the newer games that don't necessarily follow this trend. But, you know, they just feel like different colored mazes. You know what I mean? You get what I'm saying here? I'm just looking at it this way because I'm nostalgic, but I feel like some of the older Fire Emblem games, they felt like actual environments that it was in. You know what I'm saying?
Right. I feel like with the newer games, I mentioned sometimes symmetrical and bland maps. I can actually, if you look at a ton of maps, you'll find that a lot of them are symmetrical, like like different throne rooms. Here's a good one. I remember the throne room in Awakening, I believe, where you fight, I think it's Walhart the second time. And I believe even the map outside before that, both of them, if I remember correctly, are symmetrical. And it's like, in the older games, you would have had a kind of, you know, like a winding path. You would have had like two split paths and then, you know, a room with a chest that's a weird size and, you know, some stairs and some weird doors. And, you know, the throne room is kind of weird. I'm thinking about all the Ostia maps because, like, throughout FE6 and FE7, you visit Ostia, like, 18 times. Mm-hmm. So, like, you know, it's just a little bit more, I don't know, I mean, maybe it doesn't look as nice on the front, but from a play perspective, it's just more interesting to go down that, like, that winding path that isn't as linear. It makes more use of the space because you have the walls. You can't just obviously go through the walls. You end up traveling a farther distance. There's different, you know, paths to explore, like the FE8 map where you, fight Vigard, or even the map where you fight Ged, if you remember. I believe there's, like, those winding hallways. And, I mean, sure, they might be annoying in a way, but it does, like, make the maps a little bit more interesting. And now it's just very, like, the maps look pretty, but that's it.
I think it goes back to these maps just being, it goes back to this trend that we're seeing pop up a lot in this list, is that we appreciate things that are memorable. And I think you really hit the nail on the head when you said that some of the maps, especially in the GBA era, made more use of the space that the map took up. You know what I mean? I remember, you end up going up along the very razor edge of the map a lot more in those older games than you do in the newer ones.
Mm-hmm.
You end up going down a lot more like one tile hallways that are absolute nightmares because of archers and mages and whatnot. You ended up dealing with that a lot more, and I mean, you had the game plan for those a lot more.
right.
than you necessarily do have to for the.
And the enemies were more spread out and sometimes more strategically placed, as opposed to now you have a lot of clumps of enemies where it's just kind of like, all right, there's like five enemies here, and if I like bait one of them, the rest are also going to aggro, and I just kind of have to like, you know, it's just kind of like two armies clashing, you know, in one turn. It's a very like, I don't know, straight on dynamic. I remember, slight spoilers, the final chapter for one of the Fates routes is just like, it's just a race to the boss basically, because there's nowhere really to hide. There's no like, there's no paths to go down. There's not much terrain to use. It's just like, all right, I gotta kill the boss. That's the goal of the chapter. There's like 18,000 enemies in the way, and like, there's nothing I can really do. Like, I can't like forge a path and like protect everyone at the same time. So it's just like, all right, I just have to like make a beeline straight down the middle. People are gonna attack me. There's nothing I can do about it, right? And I just have to like kill the boss as soon as possible. And for me, like that wasn't as you know, enjoyable as, you know, having something just a little bit more dynamic. I mean, the final chapter in Awakening was also kind of like that, at least on harder modes. You're just kind of making a beeline straight for the front because the whole map is just one big open area. You know what I'm saying? There's nowhere you can't go, but at the same time, there's nowhere the enemies can't go either.
Yeah.
So, I mean, I think that takes care of both of those. Strong bonuses from terrain to make it more worth using. That just means terrain is basically nerfed. I mean, you know, if you want people to use terrain more, it has to be powerful. I think that's just a fundamental game concept, is that if you want people to care about a feature or use a feature, you have to make it worthwhile. Another good example would be, like, do you use those spells in, like, Final Fantasy-type games, like turn-based RPGs or whatever, where it's, like, increases your attack or, like, it gives, like, a status effect ever?
Uh-huh.
Do you use them?
I mean, yeah, I would say so. Not, like, in a tactical sense, but it's, like, convenience, you know? Like,
yeah. It totally depends. For me, I only use them if they're, like, actually, like, powerful or strong. If it's, like, all right, I use, like, one turn to increase my attack by, like, 10%, it's like, well, I might as well just attack normally, and, like, in the end, it, like, pans out to be the same. You know, like, maybe I'll get a slight benefit, but it's really not worth the amount of, like, effort, right? Like, it's easier to just, like, press A repeatedly and use that. I mean, think about, like, Pokemon, right? Like, who early game, no one's going to use Growl, usually, to, like, lower the enemy's attack, right? Like, why would you do that when you can just, like, use Tackle, like, five times in a row and, like, win that way? You know what I'm saying? So all my point is, like, if you want people to use terrain, you got to make it good enough that it's worth using. And that goes for any game design, or any game feature.
Right.
How about the next one?
Limited stats plus limited grinding to prevent reducing the strategy element by overwhelming with stats. So, and it also says here, another way to look at this might just be to state a mechanically balanced basis. So.
Yeah, I don't know who wrote this.
Yeah, neither do I. I'm
in the comments. But,
what were you saying?
Yeah, they said that, Radiant Dawn is pure raw power creep. This is just their, I'm just reading their comment on it. Interesting. So, I think basically the point of this is saying that when you limit the stats, especially to the 20s, and you also limit grinding, it makes it less of an RPG and more of a strategy game, because you can't just rely on kind of overpowering the enemies with, like, alright, I'm stronger than you, right? That's the RPG mechanic, right? Like, if you're having a tough time with a boss, you just grind so that you're a higher level and so that you can, like, beat him. I mean, you can do a strategy, like, you can use strategies to some extent, but in the end, strategies can only account for, like, so many levels in most cases, right? Like, if you're, like, level 60 and you're fighting a level 75 dude, like, unless it's, like, a very good game, at least in the older games, like, it doesn't matter how good your strategy is, you're gonna lose, right? And the FE equivalent would be, like, if you're, you know, a level 1 unpromoted unit and you're trying to fight a level 20 promoted unit, like, I don't care how good your strategy is, you're just outmatched. You're going to get, like, doubled and one-rounded, right? So, like, on the reverse side, like, if you just let people, like, grind and overwhelm the enemies with stats, then, you know, it kind of changes the experience. And then as a result, you know, everyone has their own experience because, like, let's say I don't like grinding, but you do, and we start talking about the game. It's like, yeah, like, that chapter was super easy. And I'm like, what? Like, that chapter was, like, super tough. Well, maybe it's because, like, my units, like, you know, didn't do anything, or, you know, like, they didn't do any extra, like, skirmishes, whereas, like, you did, and you have all this money from the DLC or whatever. There's definitely asymmetrical, a lot more asymmetrical experiences compared to before. But, I mean, you could also say that even in the older games, some people abused, you know, Effiet's Valney Tower or, you know, other, you know, arena abusing, right? It's not like no one ever arena abused, right? I'm pretty sure everyone's guilty of trying that at least once.
Yep.
So, and then, you know, it is what it is, but it's just a thought. Character models that don't look super odd, especially outside of battle. Okay, so what are your thoughts on, because I know you played a little bit of Fates, what are your thoughts on the character models compared to, like, Radiant Dawn?
Well, I mean, I'm not going to pretend to love the models for Radiant Dawn, but at least they felt like they made sense in a lot of ways. Like, I didn't go into battle and say, well, that's not how I pictured that character looking. And I don't necessarily mean to say that the in-battle animations don't look like the characters themselves in Awakening and mm-hmm. Fates, but there's something off-putting about, I mean,
I think it's the proportions.
There's the proportions and the way they move that make them feel like they're, like, puppets or cartoons.
Exactly. I was, like, literally thinking just that. I literally just imagined strings on them, and it feels like their body parts are being moved kind of like puppets instead of, you know, it's kind of like, all right, he's swinging his sword. I just kind of imagine a string on his arm as he's, like, swinging his arm, and I don't know, the way they run.
Yeah,
okay.
It's like,
so everyone, I have some homework for you, all right? Go play Awakening or Fates and look at the animations, and you'll see that, like, a lot of the characters, they, like, they have, like, a very, like, bent stance. They'll, like, they'll bend their body around the knees, and, like, as they run, it just looks, if you compare it to other games, it looks very odd.
I mean, not even just comparing to Fire Emblem games.
No,
games
exactly.
Have,
no, I just mean, like, compared to other games straight.
Right. Just anything,
In Japanese or Western, I mean, and the animation styles are very different, but, like, it's definitely weird.
At least it doesn't feel weird like Awakening and Fates do. Like, they don't...
Right.
Like I said, I mean, like we both said, it's they look like puppets.
I mean, despite that, they're still, like, enjoyable, but it's just a little odd, especially in cutscenes, it's a little bit more jarring. In the battles, I don't really care, because, like, they're walking around fighting, but, like, I remember in Awakening, I would, like, see, like, a cutscene with a soldier, and he would, like, he would, like, run up really awkwardly, and then, like, wait, and then he'd, like, turn around really awkwardly, and, like, run away, and I just, like... It was always just so weird for me. For whatever reason, I couldn't handle it. I mean, the fact that they didn't have feet obviously didn't help, but we already mentioned that.
Right.
All right, non-generic support conversations between parents and children. Do I even need to say anything about this? What do you think?
No, I don't think so. It's just, I think that anybody that's played Fates and Awakening know that dialogue is not their game's strong suit. I think what this particular point on the list means to say is that you don't want these characters to be flat in general. And we've talked about flat characters in Fire Emblem in previous episodes of this podcast, but it pops up again in this particular list in that these are characters, like, these are, theoretically, in theory, allegedly, these characters, the parents and the children, are real people, or are supposed to represent real people and real
personalities. Within the context of the universe, yeah.
Right,
yeah.
Within the context of the universe, but they do not feel that way when you have these conversations. You feel like you're reading something that somebody decided that parents talk to their children's like. I don't know.
Right.
It doesn't feel correct. It doesn't feel like something that you would run into in the real world.
It's almost like a placeholder, like a puzzle piece, or...
like a stock conversation.
Right, yeah. Hidden unexpected relationships between characters. There's so many of these in some games. I would say anything from... probably even FE5. I'm not as familiar with FE, the Drug Girl Saga, as you, but probably anywhere from FE4 to FE10, you can find some very interesting relationships or alleged relationships between characters.
Mm-hmm.
Do you want to list some off, some of your favorites?
Well, I think of pretty much anything with... I'm going to bring up Fire Emblem 4 in particular because they have a very similar system as far as relationships go on paper to the last two games in the series. Because Fire Emblem 4 also, if you played that game, you know, has a marriage system that results in children, and so there are a lot of relationships. But the way that these relationships, developed were infinitely more interesting. And unexpected in the way that, like, we live in the 21st century, so we have the internet that tells us what two characters are the best together. But back in the day, when you were just kind of discovering these things, you would never have thought that Beowulf and Lachesis would be good together. Considering, if you have not played Fire Emblem before, Lachesis is a princess of one of the big-time factions in the game, and Beowulf is just some kind of scumbag mercenary Han Solo type.
I mean, his name is Beowulf. I mean, that's all you need to know right there.
Yeah. And it was super cool. I mean, they're very good as far as, like, they give the children the best stats, and...
it's like Beauty and the Beast, or...
Yeah. They hit it off really well. And if you organically discovered that back when that game came out, like, that would be... I mean, that's crazy. That's super cool. And it's not just those two. Lachesis herself has another interesting relationship with Finn, who is in Fire Emblem 4 and in Fire Emblem 5, but he's a knight for Leinster. And he is also, they also have an interesting dynamic, too.
Mm-hmm. I mean, Effie, I feel like, has done this for such a long time. What I always liked is that before the characters would get very limited dialogue, you honestly didn't know a lot about them. They would always seem like kind of shallow. It's just like, all right, like, you know, I got, like, you know, the second Pegasus sister, I got another mage, I got another, you know, generic axe user, you know, like, whatever it is. But then, like, you find out a little bit about them. You find out that, like, these two characters are joined maybe during completely different times or whatever, or somehow related. You'd have characters that, that maybe met off screen, or like two minor characters would somehow tie together. There's so many good examples. You had Wade and Lot in FE6, Deke's two mercenaries, and how they had in a certain chapter, you go to the Western Isles, you meet Wade's sister, and how, like, the sister is taking care of Lot's little sister, and how they were, like, friends going out to make money. And then you have Ver and Bartray, like, would you really expect that if they didn't, like, hint it? Ver and Carol, and then Carla, who appears in, FE7, and then, you know, if you played FE7 first, and then FE6, you know, like, would you really expect the Bartray and Carla, relationship, Raven and, or should I say, Raymond, and Priscilla? You have Matthew and Guy. Remember that? Matthew's like a relatively minor character, but yet he has his, he met, like, he, like, fed Guy. He ends up being the one to recruit Guy. The only hint you get, you have to be a little bit astute, in the sense that if you skip the dialogue, you really would have no idea that Matthew's the one that needs to talk to Guy. And even then they bring up the lore of, like, House of Cairns, like, never tell a lie, or, like, they're, like, they always repay their favors, or whatever it is, I don't know. I think Guy said, like, I owe you my life, and he's like, I thought you, Cairns, like, never tell a lie, like, oh, got him. So,
And then Matthew also has a relationship with, you know, Layla. I don't know. There's so many, like, hidden, unexpected relationships. Soren and FE9 and FE10, if you don't know about him, look at him. Dude, the list goes on. I always just love these. And, it just added so much depth to these characters that otherwise would just be random, isolated people. Suddenly they became, you know, mini families or people connected in strange ways, and so good.
Yeah, no, it definitely makes the party infinitely more interesting, which is something that I think is a weak point in the newer games, where you have a lot of characters that don't really have... I mean, they're pretty much... All they are is your axe character. Your
right. Their relationship to other characters is very straightforward. It's like,
yes,
I'm your servant. I'm your retainer, whatever. You know, I'm your, you know, butler. Like, it would have been really more interesting. So, like, the butler in Fates, I think his name is... I don't freaking remember because my memory is terrible. I actually, like, kind of like this character, too. So, but, like, anyway, the main butler in Fates... It would have been really interesting, like, if he had some, like, backstory as a kid where, you know, he was, like, adopted by, you know, King Garen back in the day, and maybe he, at that time, you know, met some other person, or maybe he, you know, he came from a, you know, I don't know, a really poor family, poverty family, and then maybe you meet someone that he knew as a child, a really young child later on, and he has to, like, talk to that character to recruit that character. My point being that this has nothing to do with his job as a butler, so it adds that second dimension to him. It's like, oh, he's not just, like, this butler. He's got, like, so much more going for him, right?
Yeah,
every character has their own story.
Again, I mean, it comes back to this idea that these are characters... In, like, these characters are supposed to be representing real people
right.
in a real universe or whatever. Or at least you're supposed to play pretend that it's a real universe.
Exactly. And real people in a real universe, when you meet them for X reason. But you know that they have their own family, they have their own life and their hobbies, probably. Like, they're not just, you know, whatever you meet them for, right? Like, I meet my professor, I'm not just like, yeah, this guy just, you know, teaches, you know, the whole day. Probably he's doing something else with his life, too, and, like... It's a, you know, the people say the phrase, like, it's a small world, right? I think that goes for the video games, too, right? Like, two characters meeting and being part of the army, you know, it gives that sense of, you know, it's a small world with those relationships.
Right.
That's something I had to talk about that one for a while because it's I really liked. Another series that does that is Valkyrie Profile relationships. Between characters, but yeah. Next one is, I know we're running late here, so we'll hurry up. Characters that aren't forced to succumb to the game's constant desire to spew out dialogue, such as during battles, after level-ups, in the barracks. This is definitely a preference. There's a comment saying, besides Aen, Anherhar, I'm not even sure how to say that. Yeah, besides the characters, that they only say, like, dots. But, yeah, I mean, this is just kind of... It kind of adds to that caricature, you know, whatever. Instead of kind of imagining that, like, all right, maybe this character is saying something or maybe they aren't or whatever, it's always saying something. It's cool at first, but then it kind of starts to make them into a, I don't know, a trope, not even. What's a good way of putting it, too?
Like, how, like a caricature or a... I'm having a hard time myself, but
it just makes them feel like more and more generic. It's just kind of like,
like
we get it. Like, you know, like Kellum, your shtick is that, like, no one sees you. Like, you don't need to, like, bring that up every single time you level up, every single time I meet you in the barracks, every single time you, like, battle. Like,
it's like,
I get it. You know,
this is another overarching theme of this list is that these are supposed to be real people, but these games insist on treating these characters like jokes. Like, Kellum is a joke. That mm-hmm. is all he is. Like, he's a knight, whatever, but he's a joke.
Mm-hmm.
That's his joke is that nobody notices him. Ha ha ha, great. Like, but I got it.
It's funny sometimes, and, like, for some characters it's okay, but I kind of like the, you know, not everyone has to succumb to that. So, you know, like, okay, like, Jafar, for instance, like, if you told me, like, Jafar is gonna be, like, talking after every battle, and, you know, he's gonna be saying stuff like, you know, like, yeah, I assassinated him, or, like, you know, job complete, or, like, I don't know, like, I just imagine him, like, being forced to say stuff because the game is written in such a way, like, yeah, every character has to have a level-up quote, you know, or every character has to, you have to be able to talk to them in the My Castle and Fates so that when they, you know, when they're by the farm, they give you vegetables, and they have to, like, say some generic line about, like, finding, you know, these random carrots or turnips or whatever the hell it is, right? Like, it's just, I don't like the fact that the characters are forced to do that, basically. Not every character should have to succumb to that. The fact that they do just kind of, it feels restrictive. And again, it goes back to what you were saying with, like, they feel less like real characters and more like puppets or tools of the game.
I think it would be less of a big deal if the characters were interesting on top of that.
Mm-hmm.
Like, okay, yeah, right, it's annoying. It would
be more tolerable, yeah.
It's annoying, but, like, if these characters were all interesting, it was like, okay, it's a cutesy little...
Right, thing, yeah, like, overlook it, obviously, yeah.
But and it's not, that's not the case, you know, like, they don't have that excuse or anything.
Right, it's more like, God. It's more like, alright, there's an underlying problem, and this kind of isn't helping, right? So, yeah.
Mm-hmm.
Uniqueness in characters from limited class choices, so how do you, this is definitely another very personal preference thing. I think there's not a lot of objectivity to it, but basically in the older games, certain characters would be certain classes, and I like the way FE8 did it the most, because you had two class options, and both were, like, almost always really good fits. But, so, like, you had the option, but you always felt like it was a part of the character, right?
Right. And, yeah, that's how... I mean, I prefer that particular way of thinking as well. I think when... I remember vividly when reclassing was first released.
It was pretty crazy. Thought, like, in a way, I was excited. Like, oh, man, like, I can make Jagan, like, a swordmaster. That's pretty weird, but kind of cool.
Mm-hmm. I did not think it was cool. I never thought it was cool.
I mean, I still kind of hate it. It's novel. So, I mean... You know, I'm always open to new ideas, but for me, like, I rarely ever reclass, because I always feel like whatever class that they are is part of their identity.
Yeah.
You know, like, Carol is, like, Carol in FE7, he's a master swordsman, right? If you suddenly make him, like, a sage, it's just really weird. It ruins his identity of being, you know, the sword demon or the sword saint.
It definitely harms your immersion into the game. And especially in these new games where the characters don't have that much personality to begin with, you're already, like, dismantling it, you know what I mean?
Mm-hmm.
It would be one thing if, like, I don't know, if they're... I don't know. I really don't know. I still don't like reclassing, but the argument is that it adds... a lot, like, of
options and depth
and replayability, and there's definitely some truth to that, so usually I just keep my mouth shut.
Exactly.
I just don't personally do it.
Exactly. No, I feel the same way. I mean, it's optional in a sense. In a way, I feel like it's a little bit bloated, because now you have so many options. It's like, alright, if I really want to think about optimization, I'd have to consider every single class option, and for every single character, and... It's too many, like, it's too many options. I'm just like, screw it. Like, I don't care if this class is worst. I'm just going to deal with it, because I don't want to have to consider my, you know, 18 different reclass options for every single character. You know, that ends up quickly adding up to, like, 1,000 different possibilities I have to consider. Like, you know, I'll save myself the effort and everything. How about this next one?
Uniqueness in weapons due to limited availability. Now you can just buy more / use DLC.
Hashtag gold DLC.
Hashtag gold DLC.
DLC has really changed how gaming has worked. Like, really changed. Like, sometimes they're just glorified cheat codes, and I don't know. Uniqueness in weapons. Due to limited availability. So basically this means
you have very limited number of weapons in games. I especially think of, like, sometimes they're too limited, like, bolting, silence, berserk staff, you know, brave weapons, you know, obviously legendary weapons, but, I mean, even legendary weapons, you can get those through DLC now, or at least in Awakening you could, right? So it's like, oh, you want more legendary weapons? Well, just go get the, just go play the DLC. You can get as many legendary weapons as you want. You can also buy brave swords however you want and forge them. You can also, you can basically buy and forge almost anything that you would want. So it definitely changes that limited availability aspect of like, oh, like I only have this one brave sword. Who the hell is going to get it? Who's going to use it? How much am I going to use it? All right.
Yeah, no, that was a big thing in particularly the GBA era, that it was, you had to really, like, ration your weapons. I remember definitely some instances in Fire Emblem 6 where I did not have, we're talking a lot about Fire Emblem 6 today, where instances in which I had a lot of weapons that I had been using for a while, so I did not have a lot, whole lot of uses, but I did not have a whole lot of money. So I had to be really careful, and that added another, like, dynamic to these games. And not just, like, weapon, like, being careful with weapons in general. In particular, I'm talking about, it felt like, I mean, they gave you all the, like, the, they gave you badass weapons, like, the legendary weapons, kind of, like, towards the end of the game, but not at the very end. Like, if you got that legendary weapon and just used that for the rest of the game, you would run into a problem. You couldn't do that.
Yeah.
You know? Because you would use it up. So you still wanted to, I mean, use it when you had to.
Right.
But, I mean, it definitely, it reminds me of, like, in Doom, where you only wanted to use the big guns when you were battling the boss. I only ever wanted to use those legendary weapons when I'm like, nothing else works.
Right, yeah, exactly, exactly. It's always like, use your lower end whenever you can. I mean, I still play that way.
Oh, yeah, me too.
You know, sometimes I'll like, all right, I could kill this guy in two shots with an iron sword or one with, like, you know, a silver sword. It's like, all right, like, I'll use a silver sword, right? Like, but, yeah, I mean, generally speaking, you're right. The next one is definitely debatable. Support conversations mid-battle, that's honestly just a different way of doing support conversations. You could argue for either or. You could say that it's weird having it mid-battle because it, like, it ruins the immersion, it doesn't make sense. You could say that having it after is maybe a little bit more generic because, like, in Awakening, they're, like, they're always in a base, or, like, they're always in camp or whatever. I'm not going to say too much about that. It's just a change. It's definitely not a better or worse change. So yeah, you don't
have anything
to say about that, do you?
I don't really have anything to say about that either.
Okay. More serious / curiosity piquing conversations, mostly lighthearted / funny. This just goes back to what we were saying with the change in writing, how it's not, you know, instead of, like, adding, you know, a lot of different connections, you know, between things and, you know, hinting towards, you know, weird backstories or, you know, weird motivations for characters. You know, it's generally just a lot more lighthearted. The motivations are pretty clear, especially in Fates. The motivation for everyone is just that they all love Curren, apparently.
I always felt...
Or they love someone who loves Curren. So it's, just revolves around Curren. Like, if in a relationship chart in Fates, it would just be Curren in the center with a line going to everyone else. Like, that would be it.
I feel personally, I mean, I've said this a few times. I don't think I've said this on the podcast, though, that a good way of, it's a good way of making these characters more interesting, too. Like, it's, I don't know, like, if you make characters talk in a certain way, like, I feel like most of the dialogue in Fire Emblem is purely used to forward the plot or make jokes.
Mm-hmm.
You get what I'm saying? You don't necessarily get a lot of personality from the conversation. So what I would say, I would like to see more conversations that Brittany's
natural conversations.
Natural conversations that bring these personality the aspects of their personalities to the forefront.
And I think, that's part of what support conversations are supposed to do. But for the, especially for the main characters or as characters are joining, you definitely want to do that to kind of, you know, pique people's curiosity in the first place.
Yeah.
Yeah, you're totally right. Do you have anything else to say?
Nah, not on that front.
All right, fair. So we just have two more. These are kind of related, and then we're done. We've been going for a while. Yep. Side quests from a special, sometimes tough conditions, such as beating a chapter within a certain number of turns. I really like this. And the next one is kind of related. It's multiple part chapters or chapters without a break on the world map. The reason why I say these are related is because they both come to just kind of making the flow of the campaign or the whatever you want to call it a little bit more interesting and dynamic, and also sometimes it changes up the plot a bit. So, I mean, I think of a game like FE6 or FE7 especially. These games have lots of different side quests. Honestly, FE6, I still have to, like, double-check the guide just to make sure. Like, I don't want to miss, you know, all the legendary weapons after all these years, right? So, you know, it's like, all right, beat this chapter within 25 turns. Suddenly you have a lot more motivation to, like, play the chapter seriously and not just turtle. You also have the, you know, the kind of challenge and reward. You have sometimes that changes the plot, like you have to keep a certain character alive. And then if that character is alive, then the dialogue changes. That's always more interesting. You have some really weird requirements in other games too. Remember the double side quest chapter in FE7?
Yeah.
He had 19XX, right? Hey, yeah. They haven't had anything like that in a Fire Emblem game since then, which is just, like, crazy. You have to, like, get, like, Nils to, like, level 10 or something by, like, Chapter 7, or I don't freaking know.
And then there was a chapter where you got one route, or you got one version of a chapter if your mages were... At a higher level.
They did that a lot. In FE6, it was you go to like Ilya if your Ilian characters, for minor characters, mind you, if they were higher, if they had more experience, mm-hmm. or if your Sakaian characters had more experience, then you would go to Sakai. And in FE7, you're right. It was like if your lords had like this much experience, then you would go one route. You would fight, I think, either Lloyd or Linus. And if it was like your I don't remember if it was the mages or someone else, but like if their experience is more, you go something. And we're probably saying this totally wrong. It's probably something different. But the basic idea is that you have these like really interesting requirements for like chapter splits or different chapters. It would change the story. It adds replayability. It gives you like different motivation. It makes you like consider like which characters are you using. Another classic one is that the two different villages, you know what I'm talking about, right?
Mm-hmm.
So, like, in FE6, you had, you go to one village, you go one route, you go to another village, you go another route, right?
Yep.
And then, I think that originated from FE1, where you get, I'm really struggling with the memory here, Samson and some other character, you get one village, and then you can't go to the other village as a result. And actually, supposedly, that's what inspired Fates, which I heard this, like, in an interview or something, which is really interesting. They basically said, oh, instead of having, like, a really small-scale, like, make this decision and you can't make that decision, they wanted to do this on, like, an entire game scale, which is how they came up with the different routes of Fates. So that's some neat history right there. Did you know that, Joe?
No, I did not. I did not hear about that.
It's pretty neat stuff. I still think they could have done more with the Fates premise, but...
Definitely.
And multiple part chapters, that's like, FE9 and FE10 had them, I think. It can be a little bit annoying. I'd say still add in a checkpoint or a save point in between, because I really don't like, one thing that, spoilers for Fates, the final chapter did, is it's like two parts, and you like can't save in between. So like if you die in the second part, I'm pretty sure you have to go back to the first part. And I just absolutely freaking hate that, because I hate replaying something that I've already proven I can beat. So like if I've already proven I can beat the first part, you're not helping anything by making me have to beat that again when I just beat it. So that's the only thing I don't like. Sarah made a really interesting comment. You wonder.
I was about to say he made a very good point, where he's talking about kind of like from an immersion standpoint in spoilers for Awakening. When Emerin died, the game should not let him go from a romp in the Outrealms or save Anna and then immediately go back to fleeing from that battlefield.
Uh-huh. And this is specifically when, again, spoilers, Emerin died. So they're like, in that situation, it was like Emerin died and they're like running away from the battlefield, right? And so it's exactly as you said. It's like, all right, we're running away from the battlefield. That's the context of the next map. Mm-hmm. But in the meantime, you can, like, you know, go explore the world or whatever, you know, like, go to the Outrealms and, you know, save some villagers or whatever, and then go back to, oh, we're still fleeing from the battlefield.
Yeah.
It's raining, you know, like, that just makes no sense. It's an immersion
thing.
Yeah.
So, yeah, wow, we banged through quite a few of these, didn't we?
Dude, we went deep with some of them, too. I mean, I didn't mean to go deep with so many of them, but...
No, I didn't think we would... talk so much about some of these. This might be the longest podcast.
I mean, I think we talked about some interesting stuff. I really hope you guys have something to say. You know, again, a lot of them aren't objective. They're very just kind of, these are things that change. So, like, let us know, like, what you preferred, or if there's anything that you think is missing from the older games, or the newer game, even things that the newer games maybe did better that the older games are missing. I know there are a lot of those.
Uh-huh. And we don't talk about that nearly enough, I'm sure.
Right, yeah. I mean, you know, there's lots of things that Awakening and Fates did. Like, I wish, like, the older games did them.
Definitely.
So, I mean, maybe we'll do a podcast on that after we finish the latter half of this document. There's a second half, so...
There is a second half, which we will do, also, like, as always, feel free to let us know what what you would like us to talk about in a future episode of this podcast. If you're listening, you probably are at least familiar with our Twitter account, Fire Emblem Buzz,
mm-hmm.
which if you are not a follower, please follow. If you like Fire Emblem, we will tell you everything that you need to know about.
Thank you for the shameless advertising too. Doing your
job. Hey, well, you know what? You gotta. We out here trying. You know what I'm saying?
All right. So without further ado, this has been episode 2, super long. Hopefully, episode 3 comes before
Omega episode 17.
Fire Emblem Mobile is coming soon, so we might, if Fire Emblem Mobile comes out before we do the next podcast, we might do a podcast to discuss that, but otherwise, yeah. Look forward to the next episode of the Fire Emblem Podcast.